Interviews. Today is November 3rd, 1984, and we're in the home of John Reinhardt, who, among several important designs, was the principal designer for the 1956 Mark II Continental. But John has had a varied career in many places other than Ford, and we'd like to have him tell his story in his own words.
Good morning, Dave. I came up here from Cincinnati, Ohio, when I was 19 years old, having been through various art design schools in Los Angeles and Cincinnati, and I started at Frank Williams' studio in the Penobscot building as a letterman, designing lettering and different types of accessories for Ford Motor Company. And at that time, there was a job opening at the old art and color section on Milwaukee for General Motors Styling, the old art and color section. And I joined them under Harley Earl and Ted Hobbs, who at one time worked at Ford, and Bill Mitchell, who was my boss at Cadillac. And we worked on such cars as the Cadillac 60 Special, which was quite a classic in its day, and we worked on other cars. And then I left for Packard Motor, where I worked for 5 years on the 38, 39, 40, and 41 Packards, and also the beginning of the first Clipper.
John, may we move you back a minute?
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about Bill Mitchell and Harley Earl, and then
conditions
at GM at that time.
Well, I can do that.
Please.
Bill Mitchell was a very genial type of boss, and he had such people as Paul Brown and Roy Brown, no relation, who Roy Brown at one time later designed and worked on the Edsel, and I was working on instrument panels and interiors for the 60 Special. And Harley Earl was the most imposing figure I've ever worked for. He was like God. When he walked into a room, the air parted away and we all knelt down and genuflected. Literally. I mean, he just made that kind of impression on a young designer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We were all scared to death of him and sort of awed by his presence when he walked in. And he was about 6 foot five or six or eight, somewhere along in there. And when he looked down on you, you know, you already felt beaten into the ground, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was quite a person to work with. Bill Mitchell was very ambitious and made his way to the top. And in the meantime, it was the end of 37 or 38, and they laid off a bunch of us, about 70, I guess. And I went to work for Gordon Burig for a year down in Auburn, Indiana. And we had the King Sealy account for instrument panels and the hospital account and the Labatt's beer account in Canada.
Really?
And we had about five accounts. And I did all of the illustrating for him while he went out and beat the bushes for more work. And it was interesting because Gordon Burig at that time was a very controversial figure. He had just he came from Duesenberg originally and designed the Cord and designed other such cars as the Auburn Speedsters.
Those boattail specials?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he was sort of a hero to all designers because he beat his way up from, you know, from the boondocks from Indianapolis, where he worked at Duesenberg. And pardon me. And so I worked for him for a year and a half, and then I went up to Packard with all my drawings, and Warner Gubitz hired me. And I worked with him up to 42 when the war came along, when they transferred me over to the Packard Rolls-Royce section, where I did all the data books during the war for the Rolls-Royce engine, which were put into the Spitfire. And
was
I think,
that the
I think yes. Mm-hmm. And I think the other one was the 47, the P-47. Mm-hmm. And then I was I found a better job at Bud Manufacturing, designing, or rather illustrating, perspectives from blueprints so that the fellows on the production line could build the Studebaker war trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Gordon and Virgil Exner had moved down to South Bend to work for Raymond Loewy, and they hired me and doubled my salary, so I couldn't very well refuse that.
You and Gordon got along pretty well, I think.
Oh, yeah. We worked together three different times,
mm-hmm.
and Exter was a wonderful guy, too.
Tell us about Virgil.
Loewy was one of the greatest gentlemen for whom I've ever worked.
Mm-hmm.
And
tell us a little bit about Raymond
Loewy. X was a fine designer, and he was in charge of the Pontiac studio when I was working for Bill Mitchell.
Yeah.
And so he transferred with Loewy, and he was down in South Bend, and he and Gordon both had identical jobs as managers, and I worked for both of them. And Loewy was one of the most sophisticated gentlemen I've ever met. He was an absolute jewel to work for, and if you let some of it rub off, you could learn an awful lot from him. A lot of people fought Loewy because they thought, well, he doesn't do the designing, he does the promoting. Well, that's the reason we were working for him, because he was the greatest promoter I've ever met. And he had homes then in Popocatépetl in Mexico and Palm Springs, and La Sense in France, which was, I think, the old home of King Henry VIII, magnificent place. And he had a beautiful home on the Avenue Montaigne, across from the Hotel Plaza Athene. And he was just every man's dream of what a designer should be. He had a big office in New York, where I worked for quite a long time, and we did the post-war Studebaker under him, and when we were finished, why, he asked me whether I'd go to London, England with him and work on the Roots Group cars, which was a small type of GM subsidiary, and they had the Hillman Minks and the Humbers and the Humber Snipe and the Humber Super Snipe and the Humber Pullman, and they also had the Comer truck, and they had the Sunbeam Talbot,
oh, yeah,
which was a lot of cars.
Sure.
We worked all of them in Niagara. We worked on all of them within a 9, 10, 12-month period, and there was no food there, and so we were originally going to bring our families over, but due to the lack of food, why, we stayed there and finished it up in a hurry. I lost 47 pounds over there in 9 or 10 months.
Yeah.
That's a good way to go on a diet. No more notches in your belt.
Right.
And I used to have a chauffeur pick me up every morning in Dunchurch, which was a little town outside of Coventry, and chauffeur drive me up to the door, and he'd say, I'll pick you up at 5 o'clock, sir. And then he'd pick me up and take me back to the Dun Cow Hotel, where we'd drink stout and what little food we could find with Mrs. Mac Weston, who owned this place. She had a big silver plate in her head from a bombing raid, and I guess she got violent headaches, so I helped her get over them by drinking all her Guinness stout. It was interesting.
It must have been.
We lived on Queen Street off Curzon Street, which is next to Shepherd's Market, which is the biggest questionable neighborhood, I understand, in London. All the pretty girls stay there. They charge for their services. And we came back on an old boat, and we went through three or four storms, and I came back to South Bend, and they were regrouping, so I joined Packard. And the first time we had designed the first Clipper and ended off with it, and when I got back to Packard in 47, of course, while we had, after being at Humber, we worked on the 47 Packard, the 48, the 49, the 50, and the 51.
Tell us about design problems you might have had on that, or production problems. Were there any?
No, not too many. The only car that I didn't design in that lineup was the 48, which had been done in lieu of lack of people at Packard by Briggs Manufacturing, and they designed that big fat Packard in 48,
mm-hmm.
which we call the overturned bathtub. Well, that particular car won the design award for the year.
Oh, no. From whom?
There was a fashion awards design yeah. of the year, and all of the cars literally looked like that, the Hudson
mm-hmm.
and the
yeah.
the Kaiser Fraser and
yeah.
the... The Nash, and all of those different cars had the same configuration on the side, which made them look fat, bloated, and overeaten, you know, stuffed.
Were you able to reverse that trend in the 49, 50, and 51?
Well, the 48 and 49 were the same car, literally, and in 50, well, we managed to put out the 50 and 51, and we got it down to a sleeker proportion, and that was pretty well liked. I finally left on the 52. You were 3 years ahead in design,
mm-hmm.
and as a result, I got acquainted with Dolorosa and Bourdonnais over at Ford, and they hired me into the Ford studio under McGuire, and I think I went downhill as far as being a manager was concerned, because I had been in charge of all of the designs under Ed McCauley and Warner Gubitz at Packard.
Yeah.
But when I went to Ford, I made more money.
Mm-hmm.
So I took that job in charge of exteriors and worked for McGuire for a year.
What was the situation there in the early 50s at Ford in the design center? Can you elaborate on that?
It was pretty rough under different managers.
Was Hershey still there?
Hershey was there.
And
Hershey took my job at Packard, and he came over a year later.
I see.
Yeah, that's the way that worked.
But you were working directly under Bob McGuire.
Yes.
And who was he reporting to? Do you remember?
Bourdonnais. And Westinghouse, who was our engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Westinghouse.
Charlie Westinghouse.
Yeah.
The Walker influence, what was that at this point at Ford?
Well, he came in at that time, and he was a consulting designer with Elwood Engel and Joe Orris under him.
Yeah.
And it was their job to come in and make a competing design in these studios, and then the board of directors would choose one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you find this an awkward situation?
It became pretty hairy at times because, naturally, being a consulting designer, Walker preferred his own designs to ours, you know. So it was a little, you had to be sort of a diplomat. It was a diplomatic course that we took going through the middle of the landmines before we got blown up, literally. And finally, Walker was made vice president of Ford, and his Joe Orris and Elwood Engel joined us. So there wasn't this gigantic competition anymore. We all got along a lot better as a result.
Mm-hmm. Because of this in the early 50s, was there any glitches in the design decisions that were made in the early 50s? If you had this competition from the outside?
I assume there was. I remember of many, many times when we would have preferred one model over another, but that was not necessarily the fault of any of our consulting designers. It was a mixture of our executive board of directors and vice presidents and so forth, and almost everyone likes a different type of design.
Yeah.
So it's pretty hard to point a finger at any one of these things, because everyone was trying their best in their own way to make what they thought was the best looking car on the road, of course. And we were literally competing against Chrysler and GM and American Motors to a lesser degree.
Mm-hmm.
And We had some awfully good designers at Ford at that time.
How was McGuire to work for? Was he a good...
It was almost impossible.
Was he?
Yeah, I loved him, but I hated him. He was a mixture of promotion and malice, and when he'd have a little libation way, he was the best guy you ever found in your life. And he was the type of person you ran between liking and despising, you know. But he did what he thought was right. And at that time, Art Querfield, who was in charge of interiors for Ford, and Johnny Nager was in charge of instrument panels and instrumentation, and I was in charge of exteriors. And we used to have our meetings every night after work and tell Bob everything we had done, and he would evaluate it. And he did a good job in his own way. And I was transferred after a year and a half across the hall to Bill Schmidt's studio. And Della Rosa, who was over there, mm-hmm. came over to Ford's.
Ah.
And,
so in fact, you switched.
Yeah.
What was Bill Schmidt's studio? What was that?
That was Lincoln.
Lincoln.
And we designed over there the 52, the 53, the 54 Lincolns, which all won the Mexican road races at that time.
Remember,
and they were quite famous. They weren't the super sophisticated jobs that came later, but they were fast and maneuverable, and boy, they just run all day long. I got caught in one of our 1954 Lincoln convertibles going down through Sydney, Ohio one night at 120 miles an hour. And these things would literally fly. If they'd had wings, they would have taken off. And
who was that great driver you had in those years? Chuck Stevenson, was it?
Possibly.
Who won all the Mexican
I think that's true.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had my family sleeping in the back seat.
Oh.
And I saw these lights turn around and start to follow me, and I thought, I wonder what they want. You know, well, I got up to Sydney, Ohio, and found out they had set up a roadblock for me. I bailed my way out with money and told them, I said, I always traveled at that time of night so I wouldn't bother anybody.
Right.
And that seemed to please them very much. Because this car was one of the fastest cars I've ever driven, and I wish I had it today. So from there, we went to the Mark II Continental, and I left Bill and went over into the cornfield at the old trade school and worked for young William Clay Ford.
Now let's stop a moment, John, and take it a little more slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us some of the details of how this all came about, if you could. Some of the details that only you would know.
This job apparently had been flying around styling, and Bill Ford was... the rumors were that Bill Ford was going to come in and design a car, which was patterned after his father's car, the old Continental, which was a classic, and still is. And I love it better than all of them that have come since. The 41 Continental that Edsel designed was just so beautiful that I just fell in love with it. And Gil Spear had several Continental designs in his studio. And Della Rosa, I think, was asked to come over and design for Bill. And I think they were all shy or afraid to leave their studios and work for Bill, who was unknown at that time.
The youngest Ford brother.
Yes. So I was number three in line, and I said, sure, I'll be glad to. So ignorance is bliss. You don't know what you're going to get into, but I've been doing that all my life. So I took a long shot and went over to the cornfield, and the boys that were at the trade school were still leaving and breaking Coke bottles against the library doors when I got there. Yes, literally. It was like winning the Detroit pennant for the Tigers. They were breaking all the bottles and tearing up the whole place before they left, you know.
This is on the site of the present world headquarters, isn't it?
Yes, in back of it.
Yeah, back of it.
And so I finally... the job was a terror, really, because you weren't allowed to hire any designers away from Ford or any engineers except Gordon Burig, who joined me in Harley Cop.
Uh-huh.
So I had designers that I hired from Packard, Charlie Faniff and Bob Jones and some of the other fellows, and I had I went out to the Art Center School and hired 17 of their students and trained them all.
Pasadena?
And, yes. And no, this was at 51 3rd Street at that time, but it's in Pasadena now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I had some fantastic designers that I hired, and some from the old Studebaker group came up and joined me. And
the gentleman named Wong in that group?
Paul Wong was with me.
Yes. Yes.
Very fine man. Still at Ford. And I had two or three fellas from Yugoslavia and a couple of fellas from Canada who came over, who were metal men and clay modelers and fantastic talents,
wow.
You know, just great. And Charles Carestes, he's still down at Ford.
Uh-huh.
And he brought in Louis Turi, who was our cleaning man, who wore a magnificent racing coverall with his coat of arms on the side. He had escaped from Yugoslavia with Karestis.
Mm.
And he asked me whether I could use a cleaning man. Well, this fella came in and he made me feel like the cleaning man. He had a smart little mustache and he came in and saluted and clicked his heels. And I felt as if I should be working for him rather than the other way around, you know. He did a magnificent job. We all loved Louis. He was sort of a mascot around the design section.
What was his main?
Louis Turi.
He
was a very wealthy man from Yugoslavia who had huge estates,
mm-hmm.
and he had somehow escaped with Charlie Carestis over to the America, the colonies they called them.
Yeah.
And I hired both of them, and I also hired some of the fellows from Canada, and they were fantastic workers, and they had such a beautiful way of working. You know, they were really artists,
uh-huh.
and if the whistle blew, it didn't make any difference. They were so glad to be with Bill and I at the design section. They'd work all day and all night if I asked them. You know, and I had some wonderful people, and it was probably a blessing that they wouldn't let me hire anybody from Ford, because these fellows all gave this car a certain flavor. Stanley Brom, for instance, fashioned our first plaster model, and we wanted an interior in it. This had never been done at Ford before. They always have an interior studio, and they have an exterior studio, but they'd never mated the two, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we took this plaster model, and we hollowed out the whole thing and put in one of the interiors just as it would appear in production. It was made out of red and gray broadcloth, and we painted the car black, put in the instrument panel in a bridge of wear leather just the way it would appear, and we took it over to the styling patio at the main styling section and showed it to the executive board of directors. And Ernie Breech was so concerned that he could drive it that he went over and pulled on the door handle, and he pulled the door handle right out of the plaster, and he had it in his hand. You couldn't get in, and there was no motor, but he thought it was runnable, you know.
It was that
realistic. And after that, we got a little more admiration and a little more money coming our way, because they'd never seen one of these before, and they still aren't making them out that way. They make an interior, then they make an exterior, then when it goes down a production line, they see what they've got. But we wanted to make damn sure that we saw through the instrument panel and then looked over the hood and saw exactly how it would appear when it got on the road. They'd never done this anywhere.
It's the old way.
Yeah. And so it was a sort of a sensation. And
what year was this? There, it was about 54, 53?
Yeah, 54, I think.
Yeah.
And then in 55, we got that real nice design plant down by, I guess it's I-94.
Yes.
And Oakwood and I-94.
Yeah. It's now the.
I built the styling section there, so that it would have a balcony. It's the only styling section I've ever seen with a balcony. We had a balcony all the way around so we could look down on the plan view of the car. Nobody had ever thought of that before. They thought that was wonderful. They'd come over and all the board of directors of grounds look down at the back, look down at the front.
the way it's hit from the second or eighth floor of a hotel, you know.
Sure.
Well, we had a lot of things there that they thought it was wonderful. They'd come over just to see what the hell we were going to do next, you know. And
how about your former comrades in...
A lot of innovations there.
Yeah. How about your former comrades in Fort Stanley? What did they think of it? You'd run into them occasionally.
Well, they call us the country club. They never could realize that we were doing any work over there. And many times we'd work all night. I'd just take my shirts, sleep on Bill Ford's couch, and wake up the next morning. And Eileen Grenier would come in and shake me. And, John, Bill's coming in 20 minutes. You better get out of here. So I'd go in his bathroom, you know, wash up and put on a shirt and sit in the meeting, you know. And we'd do another day. Well, I'll tell you, we used to work so hard over there, and nobody knew it. They called us the country club,
yeah.
And they thought we weren't doing a damn thing because Bill was taking care of us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that wasn't necessarily true. We worked awfully hard. And then we put out this first one, and we put out the second one, the one for 58. Yeah, it was 58. God, I get all my years mixed anymore. And at that time, Johnny Nager and Elwood had put out a Lincoln over at their end with Chinese headlights. Remember those slanted headlights?
Yeah.
And they claimed they liked ours better, but they made us work around the Chinese headlights. So that sort of bombed us out of the cornfield and out of Oakwood. And I had to replace all my boys in the main styling section. And I was once again under McGuire with Mary Sirius, my secretary, down to the bottom of the stairwell until Dick Morris hired her. And she was a wonderful girl, a little Greek girl who worked very hard and beautiful. My wife said she was the most beautiful secretary I've ever had. And I think she must have been. And
can we back up a bit, John, and tell us a little bit about the infighting that went on because of this decision? You had a very successful car, production.
I know that Bill Ford became very discouraged because he thought our second car was a limousine type instead of a two-door, you know, which I wanted all along. And it had a window in the back that slid up and down, the first ones, and they adopted that on the Mercury and the Lincoln later.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill was, I think, very discouraged, so he was put as vice president in charge of styling and design at that time, but he later bought the Lions, I think, to keep him busy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
was this Ernie Breitz's and Henry HF2's decision that the Continental Line...
Well, it was a board of directors, and this one had already been approved, and they couldn't see putting out two different models of the Lincoln Continental.
Oh,
so what I had to do was take the Chinese headlight version and work around a Lincoln and make a Continental out of it.
Oh.
And it was a difficult job. The car was never the same after that. So We had put out our Mark II, and that was about as... And the big trouble with the whole thing was that the board of directors, Williams and Crusoe and Breach and Henry and Benson and every one of them, could not believe that you could ever sell a car for $10,000. Well, now they're selling it for $26,000, you know.
Yeah, right.
So it shows how wrong even a committee can be. And if anybody had had the foresight to believe that someday we'd be selling cars for $26,000, we'd probably still be designing today on the same car, you know. But nobody did. So they really put us out of business because of the price, not the design.
No, the design.
That was unfortunate.
Yeah.
So I went back to the old styling section and worked in a Lincoln studio and put out the cars up until 60. And then in 61, Elwood designed the... Elwood and Little Nager designed a 61 Continental, which was quite nice, a slab-sided beast with horizontal headlamps.
Mm-hmm.
I even bought one at U.S. Steel.
Mm.
And in 58, I was hired away from Ford by U.S. Steel as a design and marketing director, and really, I think, a PR man or a promotional expert to get the designers and engineers down to our laboratories in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, and show them all of the different steels. For instance, there were over 400 different types of stainless steels, and we had Man 10, Core 10, Tri 10, and T1 steels for all of the different areas, in addition to galvanized steels. And I later made up all of the steels with that were plastic coated in special designs for refrigerators and stoves and different cabinets and so on. And we put out promotional books every year like those. And I had huge shows for everyone at Cobo Hall every year where we put out these full-size models.
Yeah.
In some cases, all of the trucks were running models, so you could drive them, and also the taxi cab, which was way ahead of its time, and all done without tooling. They were all done with a brake press. And I took them over to Chrysler when they asked me to, and Townsend got very angry. He said, "Why are you bringing your models in here?" He says, "I have all the best designers in the world." He got very angry with me.
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, sir," I said, "we spent an awful lot of money to bring this message to you." And I said, "It's not not our right to tell your designers how to design." I said, "This is just one of many designs that could be made if your designers wanted to make it out of our steel." And so I don't know whether he ever got the message, but he wasn't too friendly about the whole thing. But he was the only one out of the whole bunch. Ford loved our cars, and I took him into their styling exhibit areas, and American Motors sent us letters, accolades, and GM thought they were fantastic. Bill Mitchell flew down his private plane and made a talk at the Duquesne Club about what a wonderful job Reinhardt was doing, which didn't hurt me a damn bit.
No.
You know, the guy said, "Boy, if Bill Mitchell flies down here and talks about this way, Reinhardt must be doing something, you know."
Give us some details, John, about how you put that unit together. This was unique at U.S. Steel, was it not?
Well, we used the local talent in Detroit to build these models. Creative Industries did this advanced station wagon, and Auto Dynamics did the taxi cab. Paramount Engineering did some of our trucks, and they were all done with a simple wrap, you know, so that they could be made. And it was so simple, but then, and there wasn't any tooling there except a brake press, which is a simple way of bending in a straight line. In other words, you don't have compound curves. And it was such a simple way to do all these buses they have today with the panel delivery trucks and so forth, you know, because they're literally just a straight line bent over.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need tooling for all that if you don't want it. You can make, nobody cares and nobody knows really of those fellows that buy those cars. They want something that's utilitarian that they can sleep in or pile their stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them want windows and seats, and some of them want to put in merchandise. But there's such a simplified structural way of building all these cars that I never knew why these people never grabbed onto it and did it, you know. Gee, Checker Cab went crazy when I put that taxi cab out, but they were using that same old tooling for 20 years, and I think they're still using it, you know.
They never changed. Yeah. Well, this was rather unique, was it not, for a steel company to ask an automotive designer to come and build a unit that would...
U.S. Steel was the talk of the world, yes. Not the country. People from South America used to write me for these books in England and France and everywhere. We just sent these books all, and we keep running out of them. And they were quite expensive with the hardcover and all of the work we'd put in, the research. One of the biggest jobs I had was going to each steel manager and telling them all of the, and getting them to tell me all of the different steels they had. At first they wondered what a designer was coming in there to get all their steels for, and after they saw the first book they went crazy, you know.
Yeah.
Then it was easy. But they were just they were antagonistic because they thought I was coming in and trying to steal all of their jobs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they found out all of the books we were putting out, they thought they were the greatest. And U.S. Steel became the leader for almost 15 years until I left. Ed Gott came in finally, and Dick Centner, who was our president, had retired along with Chappell, Dick Chappell. And Ed Gott called me and said, well, now we're going to concentrate on sales and not any more styling and design or promotion or marketing. And I was doing the railroads and the agriculture and the tractors and all of the different areas for product design and automotive design and truck design. And I said, Mr. Gott, I said, you need somebody to promote all these things because we're doing fine. We got an awful lot of customers buying our steels now, and all of these covered steels, you know, and all of the galvanized steels in the proper areas. And he said, well, we're only interested in sales. So I gradually cut down all of the departments, and I retired from U.S. Steel, and I went back to Bill, and he hired me back into Ford as a liaison designer between Dearborn and Ghia, mm-hmm, in Italy. So under Dolorosa, I was doing all of the design for them over there, and then I'd fly back. It was a 16-hour trip and terribly tiring. Mm-hmm. We'd get there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, dead tired from 16 hours of flight, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk about jet lag, boy. Mm-hmm. And we'd work all day, and I'd sit in meetings and pick up all the drawings and give them the designs that Dolorosa and Bourdonnais wanted, and stay there maybe a week and then fly back. Mm. And I worked out of the international studio, and it was an interesting job, but it was terribly hard on the body, flying back and forth. And then eventually I got put into interiors, and I worked on 82 and 83 seats for John Aikens. And after that, well, I retired. And we had some fantastic seats that were made out of steel mesh that I had developed at U.S. Steel. And they were actually just as comfortable as all the springs and all the rest of the stuff you put into a seat, except they were a simple thing held into position by a band around the bottom. Mm-hmm. They're held in tension, you know, when you sat on it, why the thing would spring up and down. They never built that either. Mr. God, I came up with so many innovations for these fellas.
You're just too far ahead of your time.
They just would not look at them. I don't know what the problem was. So I finally thought, well, I guess it's time for retirement. And I got two real nice letters, one from Henry and one from Bill. And I had the most wonderful thing happen to me after I came back to the main styling section and worked in the exterior Lincoln area. Henry would come in with Mr. Breach in the morning, and he'd say, good morning, John. He says, we just dropped in to find out what the hell you're designing in here. You know, we have to drive these horrible things. And I always got a kick out of Henry. He put it right straight to you. Well, he said whatever he liked. And, well, he could. He was chairman of the board. Yeah. And we loved him for it. And I'd set him down on two old stools that we had there and take him all through the sketches and designs and so forth and show him all the clay models. And when he and Ernie were happy and pleased, why, I'd take him across the hall and introduce him to the interior group. We're doing all the instrument panels and so forth and seats and so on. And they were in awe of these people because they'd never met them before, you know, and I'd introduce them all around, and then they'd take them down the hall and show them the whole works. And Henry always took a very sincere interest in what we were doing because, as he said, he had to drive them, you know.
And he did.
Yeah. And he was a terrific guy to work with. And
let's take you back, if we may, John, to the inception of the Mark II. Tell us, if you can, the respective roles of yourself, Bill, William Clayford, yourself, Harley Kopp, and Gordon Buring. How did you intermesh on that, on the creation of the Mark II?
Well, the board of directors didn't feel as if we were professionally qualified to design that fine a car, so that they asked us to hire four or five other designers to compete with us. So we made a grid pattern. Charlie Faniff made this up, God bless his soul, and we had a three-quarter front, a three-quarter rear. We had a plan view, we had a rear view, a front view, and a side view. Mm-hmm. And they had to be all to scale. And all done in Honolulu blue, which was Bill Ford's favorite color. And we hired George Walker, who's one of our competitors, and Walter Buell Ford, and Vince Gardner, and who else? Another one, I forgot. Oh! Miller and Grissinger.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. Grissinger later became a designer for Mercury.
Is that Buzz?
Yes.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And so we went through the whole thing, and everyone made theirs out of Honolulu blue, and every one of them made, I think, four different versions of what they thought the Continental should be, and we made ours. And we put them all there, one, two, three, four, no names, no nothing. Nobody knew who had designed them. And when everything was done, why, the one that I had designed was selected. Mm-hmm. So we were quite elated. However, if I had had a selection myself, there were a couple of other ones there I would have selected in preference to our own. I've never been of a type of person to say my design is absolutely the best if something else is better than mine, mm-hmm. in my estimation. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are jealous. They'll fight for their design all the way through. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's necessarily so. If you see 20 good designs, there's probably something in that menage that you would like maybe better than your own. And there were a couple of them that I just thought were closer to what the old 41 Continental looked like. And in my humble opinion, they might have been selected and been just as good or better than ours. However, we pushed on with ours, and it had a spare tire, and that's how the Mark II came out.
And whose idea was to make that distinctive spare tire?
I did that.
That was yours?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I did that.
How did
because,
that come out?
Because we didn't want a full tire on it like the old 41. You know, right. That was outside, yeah. And it was covered. Mm-hmm. And we thought if we put the spare tire directly inside and put that bump over the top,
the molding,
and spread it out, it would make a lot cleaner design, and which it did. Mm-hmm. Here's the design here.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And originally I liked that little hubcap in the center too with a Continental around it, which didn't come out that way at all. And this is Harley here in the center. Harley Kopp,
oh,
and that's
yes.
Bob Thomas,
uh-huh.
And that's Bob Thomas here, and that's me.
Oh, yes.
I'm the tall guy. We look quite a bit different in those days. I look a little different in this book, too.
You're very handsome in that, yes.
Well, it's, I always thought I looked like an old crow.
Not at all.
I always had a hook nose. However, it was an interesting decision that the board of directors made, mm-hmm. and after we got through with it, there were some great designs there that could have been used. And
you remember who did them offhand?
Well,
the ones you like.
Vince. Oh, the ones I like. The one particular one I liked was done by one of the fellas that had bought out George Walker's industrial design studio over in the new center building.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I think his name was George Fetty. I'm not sure,
mm-hmm.
but. They had four or five good designers over there who had originally worked at Ford, and then they went over and bought out George's place at the Art Center Studio,
mm-hmm.
Art Center Building,
mm-hmm.
New Center Building it was, pardon me. And then Vince Gardner had a real nice one, and Miller and Grissinger were a little too far out. Theirs were more advanced and didn't have any of the old Continental feeling that I thought was mm-hmm. permissible. But everyone did their best, and they deserved an awful lot of credit. So
the decision was made, and you're on your way.
Yeah.
And how did it work from there on in? Had Gordon Gehrig been with the company, or did you bring him up from?
No, he had been over in engineering and. He agreed to come with us because he knew me, of course, working on a post-war Studebaker and being in England with Lowy. And Harley Kopp was a newcomer in our group, but he was a very good chief engineer. Very generous and also very strict. He's sort of a nice type of McGuire.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And we got along fine with him. And then we had Ben Mills, who came over later. We were all scared to death of Ben until we got to know him, and he became one of my best friends. And he was my boss over at Lincoln Studio when I got back. And we had Jim Nance from Packard, who was hired by Ernie Breech.
Had you known Jim at Packard?
No, I hadn't. And he was a terror. He'd come racing in about 5 hours late for our meetings out on the patio, all out of breath, and by that time our clay models were melted on the ground under the sun. We had a terrible time with Jim. He never could keep appointments on time. But other than that, I guess he was very efficient because he had a lot of famous jobs around the country.
Never stayed in one of them very long.
No.
So
that's the way it happened.
It's quite a nice time here. You've got approval. You've got billboard behind you. Assembled a design and engineering team, and everybody's gung ho. For a while, it went very well, didn't it?
Went fine. We sold every car we designed and built. And I can't understand why they had this aversion to the $10,000 types, because we had no trouble selling these cars whatsoever. People would order them sight unseen, you know, way ahead of time. And we built them, and they bought them, and they loved them. And they're still loving them. There's a Continental, Mark II Continental Club around the country. This fella came in yesterday from San Francisco, and he taped the whole thing last night. And he said he wanted his people out in California to see and hear all of this, because he was a mad enthusiast for Continentals. And there was some fella in Mexico, Axel Holm, who had a complete production line rebuilding Mark IIs, and he even went as far as going back to the Bridge of Weir in Scotland and getting our broadcloths and our Matt Lassay fabrics. And anybody that needed, he rebuilt one for Bill Ford. And the guy was just the greatest enthusiast you've ever seen. And he made me promise I'd work for him after I retired. Unfortunately, he had 20 or 30 big tractors with trailers on the road going from Mexico City down to South America. And he'd bring home frozen shrimp and fish foods and everything else, and distribute them around the area in Panama and so on. And I think he had some trouble with the government. I think some of his men were peddling dope unbeknownst to him, and he really got in heavy trouble. And I talked with June Davis, who was our executive secretary of the Continental Division. She said, she says the factory looks all dark down here, and she says I don't think they're in business anymore. So there went my job when I retired. He wanted me to come down and design special cars for him.
June
Delightful
Davis
man.
June Davis was your secretary.
No. She's the secretary now for Lincoln Continental.
Right. Exactly.
And Bob Davis is he's rebuilt himself about four Mark IIs. He's crazy about it. He's an old Navy man, retired. Delightful person.
Yes, I think.
Have you?
Both of them.
Well, he and June are two of the nicest people on earth. I love them.
Yeah. Everybody falls in love with June.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She has the most vibrant laugh, you know.
Yes.
My wife is crazy about her. We've had a lot of fun with them. Well, she worked for Axel Holm at that time.
Oh, she did.
And so they were very close, and I went down there at one time.
Where was the plant?
It was in God, it was on the Arizona-Mexican border in, I never can remember that name.
Mason?
Yo? Where did Axel Home live on the Mexican border? Nogales, Arizona. It was right on the Mexican border.
In fact, they're still there.
Yeah.
The Davises, yeah.
And we went down to visit Axel, and we landed in Phoenix to see an old friend of mine, Dick Engel, before he died. And he had bought 5 acres of Cave Creek, which became the smartest place in Phoenix, Scottsdale. He sold 500 acres of Cave Creek, and he became a billionaire. Then he died of the flu.
Oh, no.
Poor guy. So sorry for him. But he, Dick was a fantastic man and a very fine artist. He and I had gone to art school together.
Dick Engel?
And he was a portrait painter. And he always told me, he says, you come down and pick out any two pictures you want, and you can have them. Well, I came down after he died, unfortunately, and I had no way of carrying these things because I was going on this trip and I never did get them. And Evie Engel died since then, so I don't know what happened to all the paintings. They're just gone. It was a tragedy, really. And when I got to the Phoenix airport in Arizona, here was this brand new Mark III waiting for me in deep red, sun top. And Alex had, Axel Home had sent it up in a truck so that I could drive a special Mark III Continental around to see all my friends and then down to his place in Nogales. And he had a huge party for us. I had my youngest son with me and Joe and myself. He had the ambassador from Mexico, and he had all of the notables from Mexico City and all of the mayors and different people from Nogales, Arizona, and Mexico, and took us to all these huge restaurants. And he had a black tie party for us before we went home, which was the grandest party I've ever been to in my life. A gigantic swimming pool with beautiful girls dipping in and out. You know, it was the type of thing you see in the movies, really. You know, and he was a fantastic host. I loved the guy. He disappeared. I don't know what happened to him. I don't know whether he went back to college or whether he has another job somewhere else. But he was the president of the Lincoln Continental Club for, I think, 2 years in a row at one time. And I never saw such an enthusiast in my life. And he used to write me all these Spanish letters and make fun of them in Spanish, you know, and I'd read them to Joe, and we'd really break up.
What was his name again?
Axel Holm.
Axel?
Yeah, a very, very wealthy kid. His dad owned this huge trucking concern, Walter Holm. And they were charming people. Very nice.
What nationality was he?
I think he was half Mexican and half American.
Yeah, dual citizenship.
He was an American as a citizen, yeah. But he was sort of a half and half. I think Walter had gone down there and married his mother. And they had this huge home and this big swimming pool, and they knew all of the notables from Mexico and the United States. You know, it was a proving ground right on the border, literally. And
partly responsible for the enthusiasm that the Mark II has held.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure he was. And June Davis and Bob Davis are still absolutely crazy about this car, and that's all they drive, you know.
Right.
They want us to come out there so badly, and we never seem to get there because I'm sort of laid up with this arthritis,
yeah,
you know. I'd love to go out and see them. They build a new home in a portion of Arizona about 10 miles away from Nogales.
Rio Rico?
Rio Rico. That's
yeah.
where they are.
Yeah.
I have never been there, but I understand it's close to Nogales somewhere. I wanted to show you these two letters I got from Bill and Henry while you're here.
Yes, I'd like to read them into the record.
I think they're very interesting myself. And I
Now, these are letters that you got from Henry Ford II.
When I retired.
And William Clay Ford.
Yeah, I think they're quite nice. I This is from Henry Ford II, and it says, "Dear John, many thanks for your letter of January 10th. I was surprised to learn that you are retiring at the end of March, but I can well understand your desire to follow personal pursuits. You have made many contributions to our progress at Ford, and I thank you very much, and I do want to take this opportunity for all of our people here at Ford to thank you for your efforts in our behalf. All good wishes for much happiness in the future and your retirement." Which I think is a nice letter.
That is very nice.
And this is one from Bill. And Bill says, "If this keeps up, I might be the only one left in the company to continue to argue the merits of the Mark II Continental. That was a marvelous period in our lives, and I hope they're the memories of Ford Motor Company that you'll take with you, because you had so much to do with making them so pleasant for me. I hope, too, that the years ahead will bring you and Joe happiness and good health."
That's what you pay for.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, you and Bill and the rest of the team had a marvelous thing going there.
We had a rapport that I don't think any other designer ever had at Ford.
Mm-hmm.
I felt very fortunate.
Was it a fortuitous circumstance, or was it by design?
Well, I think, I really don't know. I love people, and I like these two people very much. Also, Ben. Ben was a very fine person. I never worked personally for Ben, but he and I were very good friends.
Ben support.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben died, as you know, on his boat.
Yeah.
But when I joined U.S. Steel, and I had the plane to bring all of the people down in a big limousine, I felt it necessary to join a club up at this end in Detroit. So I wanted to join the Detroit Athletic Club. And I called Dick Morris, who was working for Bill Ford as an secretary at the time. I said, "Do you know anybody that would sponsor me into the DAC? He said, "Well, let me look around." So he called me after a week. He says, "I got your sponsor." I said, "What's his name?" He says, "Benson Ford." And so Ben came the time to promote me, and there was a gigantic crowd down in the lobby at the DAC, and I flew in from Pittsburgh, and I saw Ben fighting his way through the swinging door, and he came over to me, and he says, "You know, John, you son of a bitch," he says, "I don't know why I'm promoting you." He says, "You don't even work for us anymore." He spent 2 or 3 hours there getting me into the DAC, which I thought was, this is the...
The experience of creating something almost from scratch must have been quite a...
was a hell of a job. I sat there in that damn library with all of the Coke bottles flying, and I worked like a dog trying to think something up for about 6 months, and finally started hiring all these people, and it really was a hell of a lot a harder job than I thought it was going to be, you know, because it's easy when you got a bunch of young designers pushing out the designs, and you can take them into a meeting and promote them. But when you have to do all the damn work yourself, and then hire all the men, hire all the clay models, and hire all of the plaster people, and then we used the old gymnasium, which smelled like a gymnasium. God, we had to disinfect the damn thing. It smelled so bad of old socks and old shoes, we got some special jigs and fixtures, you know, that we had bought. They wouldn't even let us have any bridges or different things to make our models, you know, to make one side exactly the same as the other. So we went through an awful job of literally rebuilding a whole damn design section and engineering section, you know. Then we used the old chicken house over there or something for the plaster area, and we knocked all of the chicken coops out of it, fixed it all up for the plaster men, and all of the outhouses were the engine house where all the power came from. We used that for building up our engines. We made use of every damn thing in that place that would suffice
to do our job, and it was needless to say, some of it was pretty damn hard to work around because it wasn't built for that particular purpose in the beginning.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But,
William Clay Ford had been pushing this all through the early 50s.
I understand that he had.
There have been studies, you remember the 19-5X and the 19-5X Continental, was that early, or was that yours?
I'm not sure.
They'd come up.
What year would that have been?
That would have been about 52, I think. 52. It's my impression that he had had this feeling about his father's car.
Yeah, he did.
He wanted to recreate it in a, you know,
exactly how I got the job, I guess. Or two or three people tried it and gave up. And Joe,
yes.
Would you come here, please? And I guess that's how I fell into this thing, because I know that I remember Gil Spear having made some of these designs, and Bill Schmidt, some of the other people, and Bill wasn't quite enthusiastic about all this work in his favor. Joe, this is a this gentleman came all the way from Edison Institute.
How are you?
Joe Reinhardt, this is a...
Thank you.
Tell me your name.
I hope that you had a tape off.
No, it's on.
Oh, all right. I'll
no,
wait.
It's on. We want to hear some of your impressions over the years about the Continental experience.
Well, you'll have to make an appointment with me. I'm harder to reach than Johnny. And we're not on our guest today because I think some couple last evening overstayed their welcome.
Yeah,
really. I'm going to be his manager.
Okay. I think you should. Yeah.
Yeah. I do too.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Joe is a secretary for the Cordoba Apartments.
Oh.
And she goes to work at 12 every day and comes home at 7. She's on her way.
The experience that Bill had pushing it through the various committees, the policy committee, the executive committee, I suppose the design committee, and when he finally got it approved, was the budget sufficient for your needs at that time, the design budget? Did you have to go through a shoestring for the first?
Well, I, having been sort of a Johnny come lately, I didn't realize, of course, I was going to take this job, so I paid very little attention to that. And most of that, I think, was in the hands of Harley Cupp. And he, being a professional man, he allotted so much for cars, which we were to use, and we started out with a Lincoln chassis and body and motor, of course, and worked around that and made two or three prototypes and lowered them down to where we thought the Mark II should be, which was about 4 inches lower than the Lincoln at that time. And I have pictures somewhere of those two cars, and it's readily noticeable the one that's 4 inches lower, you know. It looks like a real Snoopy speedster compared to the standard Lincoln. And actually, it was just as comfortable. What we did was drop the frame, made a completely new frame for the Mark II. Very heavy frame, a solid frame, but we pulled it out with outriggers so that the seats would drop inside the frame. Actually, it was a much safer automobile. As a result, because if you were hit from the side, you had all this protection with just like heavy bumpers all the way through the whole car, you know. And we tried out, this was my reasoning for trying out all these different Lincolns and different things and making suggestions. And that's how I got to drive this black convertible for about a year and a half, and how I got caught down in Sydney. And boy, I'll tell you, I was a fast automobile.
Well, I was able to set up a whole division, and after some vicissitudes, and you had a separate car line, separate from the Lincoln.
Yeah. No, everything was complete, and we dunked it in corrosion-free steel, about five times before we ever went ahead and painted anything. So that the car was literally hand-built on the production line, and we had special paint, and we had all these special upholsteries, and Earl McPherson, who designed the McPherson strut for Ford, he went over to Paris with us that 1 year, and he introduced us to a firm called Tassinari and Châtel, and that's where we got all our beautiful French matelassés and our special fabrics and different things. And then we went to the Bridge of Weir in Scotland and got the special leathers. And Bill Ford enjoyed that because he used to go over and play the St. Andrews golf course. And
he used to shoot grouse over there.
Yeah, and he'd drop in and see them every once in a while to see what kind of leathers they were making for us. He really enjoyed that part of it. And so we had an interesting time. It was
In terms of design characteristics, which was your department, what do you remember that was unique?
Well, the
classic spare tire.
The car was completely different in design from anything that was being done on a standard Lincoln by Bill Schmidt, and it was a very unique rear fender design because the top was pulled in and we had these fenders instead of fins. We just ran the fenders through, and. The car didn't have the fins that were so popular at that time. It was a very severe, formal type of car compared to what was on the road.
How did you resist them? Very few people did.
Well, we called the car originally a modern, formal automobile, and we thought that with fins and all the rest of it that Exter and Ford and GM were putting on cars. You remember the huge fins on the Cadillac?
Yes.
My God, they were in 58. They were highest part on the car. I took a trip over to Italy one time to go to the Torino Auto Show, and I wound up in Rome, and I hired a. I told them I went to hire a small car so I could see Rome, you know, while I was there. Well, this fellow from the agency, he brought a 58 Cadillac four-door. He was my chauffeur. And I remember we were trying to get through some of these narrow streets in Rome, and the little kids would yell at the chauffeur. They says, "Give us the fins and we'll build a whole nother car." They were that gigantic, you know, and these little kids thought they were absolutely ridiculous, you know.
But and you came up with this severe, almost classical look, formal look.
Yeah, that was the hard part, I guess, because we went completely against all of the different cars that were out at that time. At that particular car time, Bill Mitchell came out with a car called the Eldorado, and he tried to run that through. But the Eldorado I liked very much, but the style of it didn't appeal to nearly as many people as the Mark II did, which to me was quite a surprise. I liked the Eldorado because it was over well done. It had a brushed stainless roof and beautifully handled, but apparently it didn't get off the ground at all. We've had a great time together.
Yes, I think you have.
She's a good woman.
John, let me ask you a few postprandial questions ask you about some people that you've worked with. I know you've spoken about some of them in our early part of this interview, but perhaps you could give us a more close-up look at some of the really marvelous people you worked for over the years. First off, again, some more information about Harley Earl that you haven't told us. What was he responsible for it while you were in GM?
Well, Harley, as I understand it, Harley, as I understand it, originally came from Los Angeles, where his dad owned a small custom body shop.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to the attention of GM Martin Collar, and literally, I understand, build it up.
About Harley Earl coming to GM.
Yeah, well, I understand he was hired around 27 or 28, and the first car he did was a LaSalle, and it was a very close a copy of one of the European automobiles called a Hispano Suiza.
Oh, really?
Yes, and for that he became famous, and he designed a Cadillac after that, and he gradually got a, he was so successful by his first car that he gradually started to design cars and got other stylists and designers and artists and anything he could find who could draw automobiles, and he became quite famous as the first GM overall designer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so tall and commanding that everybody was in awe and in reverence of him. You know, he was like God flowing into a room, and the air would disperse, and he'd walk in and
part the waves.
Here I am, you know. And he was a very commanding appearance, you know, being so tall and shoulders so wide, and he was a fairly handsome man for his time. And
commanding voice.
Yeah. Oh yes. Very booming.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sort of in reverence of Harley Earl because he was such a tremendous person, you know.
Mm-hmm. And, I understand he could be tough on his subordinates at times.
Jake, yes, I understand that. I never was that high, so I never had a direct association with him, but Bill Mitchell and Ted Hobbs, who became interior designer over at Ford, and a lot of other people. Ted Hobbs was in charge of Chevrolet.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for him for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Mitchell, of course, was in charge of Cadillac, and Exner was in charge of Pontiac.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a direct line to him, you know. So
mm-hmm.
I never, like at Ford, I was right up at the top talking to all these people. I never had that rapport with Harley at all because I just barely knew him, and I knew him by sight, and everybody would stand aside and salute, you know.
what constituted...
Marvelous man, I guess, and he became very famous. I met him once again down at Watkins Glen when he did the first Lee Sabre.
Oh, yeah.
He brought it down here with huge fins.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very embarrassing. He brought his mechanic along with him and his driver, and they came down to Watkins Glen to show off what a real sport car should appear to be, and the damn thing quit running. They had to take it to one of the corner garages and work on it for a day, or bring down their mechanics to make it run.
Mr. Goodrich had failed them.
That was exceedingly embarrassing.
Did Bill Mitchell have a hand in the Sabre?
I really don't know. I don't know. I was at...
By then
I was in another area at the time at Ford. But we always got a kick out of it because it looked so ludicrous and so ridiculous next to all of the little Ferrari racing cars with the bike fenders. And there was this great, big, imposing juggernaut with the super high fins.
Mile-high fins, yeah.
And I went down there 2 or 3 years at Watkins Glen with once with Gordon Burig and once with Della Rosa and his beautiful first wife. And several times we went down there and took Johnny along, who's sick today. And he was a little kid then.
Mm-hmm.
And we only went down there when the race course was on the old circuit. And they built a big, heavy race course, road racing course after that.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't the same.
It wasn't the same.
If you were one of the old first types that got there, you didn't appreciate it anymore because these fellows would get on these old roads and up the hills and over the bumps and down the bridge and make a sharp turn. And I used to stand behind trees and with my like and go fuck, fuck, fuck. These guys could have easily hit the damn tree and killed me, you know. But at that time, they had no protective measures at all. And you used to be able to hide behind a tree, and these damn things would race right by and fly leaves in your face, you know, stones and odds and ends. And it's exciting. Later on, they built this huge race course with fences, you know, 300-400 feet away from the race course so nobody would get hurt. And by the time I got to Leica set up, the damn car had been gone. It was going around half the course, and I was waiting for the next one, you know. And I thought, no. We never went back again.
Well, Bill Mitchell, or I mean, Harvey Earl is probably credited with creating the modern automotive design studio, isn't it? The old color and...
I don't think there's any doubt about that.
He pushed that through.
Yeah, I came up here when I was 19, and I heard of him even in Cincinnati, you know. I can't believe that I came up here when I was that young, because first day I got here, I was looking along Bethune Avenue right behind the Fisher Building, and I saw some guy out behind in the driveway putting the first leather instrument panel I'd ever seen in an old Chrysler convertible with the top down. And I didn't look at any more rooms along Bethune. I says, I'll take this room. And it was two twin beds, and I had no reason to take two twin beds and all this luxury. But I wanted to know this guy who was building that instrument panel. It was Vince Gardner, and he since killed himself.
Oh, no.
And Vince, I got him several jobs in Pittsburgh, and he got me two or three jobs in Detroit. We literally both helped each other get started, you know, when we were down on our luck. Vince was a terrific guy. We had lived over on Newport for a while. We lived on Bethune for a while. We had a wonderful landlady named Mrs. Shaw. And she learned to love all of us. We had all of our crazy guys in this one damn big rooming house from Cincinnati. Cal Dunn, who made the lady with her skirts, and Jules Kopp, who was a very handsome man, worked at PR for General Motors. And these guys were so good-looking, you couldn't believe it. They all had excellent jobs. We all came up together, one after another, and helped each other get jobs here and there. And I first worked at Frank Williams, and I quit and got a job with GM Art and Color. I went in to see a fellow named Howard O'Leary.
Yes.
And he told me, you go home and give your version of what an advanced car should appear to be. And I went home and I worked for 2 weeks, got everything I could think of. I was putting on colored paper and chalks and crayons and paint and the whole bit. And she'd bring me coffee in the middle of the night, and I'd have indigestion and ulcers and wondered why. She had a big black cat that would run all the way down the hall and climb up her curtains, which were in my room, and she'd just shred the hell out of everything. And one day, the next door neighbor hated this cat so bad she poisoned him, and God, I never forgave her, because he used to sit there for an hour like this damn thing. He'd sit there on my desk while I was drawing and purr away like a damn old steam engine, and you needed that camaraderie to get started, you know.
Right.
We had a grand time. This cat, and I've forgotten his name, but I was the only guy that had eventually moved across the hall from the bathroom. Five of us shared the bathroom. And I was the only guy eventually that had a little place to dress in, a little walk-in closet, and I had the balcony on the rear porch, because she says, you're the only one that takes care of these places, and you're the only one that takes care of the bedspreads and the carpeting, and the rest of them apparently poured beer and everything else all over the rooms. So every time she'd get a new bedspread or a new curtain, she'd put them in my room first. Well, eventually the guys got a little bit jealous. They thought I had an in with her, you know. Actually, I didn't. I was just used to, I guess, being more meticulous than the other guys.
More fastidious.
And we got along fine. She wrote to me from Florida for many years. She and George Shaw, and we had a nice rapport together.
This is when you were a young designer at GM.
Yeah. And from there, I went with Tom Bannister, who was one of the chief interior designers at Chrysler, and Ray Smith, who was one of the designers at General Motors. We all rented I was at Packard at that time. We all rented a big house up on Boston Boulevard behind the Catholic Church. Had a
big tennis court, gigantic front yard. And we were always arguing who should cut the lawn. And each one of us always had an excuse. The grass kept getting higher and higher. So we eventually hired somebody to cut the lawn and a lady to come in and make the beds. And
this is just a few blocks away from the General Motors building.
Oh, this was the Boston Boulevard. It was about a mile away.
Yeah, right.
And by that time, I had a 41 Packard, and you remember this? How convertibles used to be with a tiny little window in the back.
Yes.
Well, during the war, when I was at Packard, I used to bother the hell out of me. So I got a piece of plexiglass, and I pushed this window, which had two zippers on the side, down.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I fit this great big piece of plexiglass in the back of my Packard, and Christ, within 6 months, every damn car in town had a piece of plexiglass
right,
in the back.
You're way ahead.
And some guy named Robbins came over, who was since killed with his own private plane, and he says, "Is there any patents on this thing?" I says, "Not to my knowledge." Dumb me. You know?
Yeah, right.
Well, he patented the damn thing and made $1 million out of it. Bought his own plane, had his own place over here on Stevenson Highway, and he got killed landing one day.
What was his name again?
Robbins.
Robbins.
I don't know his first name.
Incredible.
But I had so many ideas that didn't materialize. I sort of a backdrop of my father,
mm-hmm.
because every damn, we had plenty of imagination, but we never had the ability to follow up. Three or four years ago, Sid and I designed a special book of all this stuff,
mm-hmm.
called The Sentinel.
Mm-hmm.
And these fellows came from Denmark, and they wanted desperately to get all Sid's stuff. And I had bought it from U.S. Steel when I left, because I thought, well, the damn bugs are going to eat all the paint. The paints and the roaches have a way of eating all of the paint off these drawings if you leave them in storage.
Really?
So, I brought all of the illustrations I could get hold of to Detroit,
mm-hmm.
and put them in a basement. These guys found out where they were, and they contacted Sid Mead, and they came to me, and I made a deal with them for $2,000 plus 10% of the books they sold, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It worked out fine. They sent me $1,000.
Great.
And, and I thought, well, that's fine. These fellas are great. And I proceeded to fix up my den downstairs so that they, with big heavy Klieg lights, so that they could take all the pictures of
mm-hmm.
all this stuff.
Yeah.
And as soon as they finished, they went out and got Sid to fill in, along with Strether McBinn from Art Center School.
Oh, yeah.
And as soon as they got all the information they wanted, they disappeared completely.
Really?
Never saw them again, never heard from them. Neglected to sign a paper, you know,
mm-hmm.
a lawful paper to mm-hmm. say that I had contributed.
Mm.
And another time went by, and I...
Chalking it up to experience.
Honest to God. Dave, I've made so many mistakes you wouldn't believe.
Oh, we all have.
One of those things that happened.
Let me move you back to Bill Mitchell. Tell me a bit about Bill and his contribution to the design history. Where would you place him?
Well, he like so many people, tried to... Bear in mind, he was a very small little guy,
mm-hmm.
smaller than me.
Mm-hmm.
And
kind of brawny.
At that time, he was very sinewy and thin.
Mm.
And now he's become quite rotund and bald.
Yeah.
So anybody that knew Bill then and now wouldn't recognize him, you know.
Uh-huh.
Except like everybody else, when he used to really push people and make them work like hell to do a job, because
mm-hmm.
there weren't unions at that time.
Right.
So the harder you pushed a guy, literally, supposedly, the harder he worked.
Mm-hmm.
So we all worked like hell for Bill, and mm-hmm. he tried to simulate everything that Harley Earl did, like so many people did.
Yes.
And when he was finally named vice president, why he settled down a little more, and Harley retired and went to Florida. And Bill, like so many people, like Elwood Engel, for instance, or Bill, or a lot of the people who are vice presidents, they always neglect to ever make a talk or a speech to anybody, because
mm-hmm.
they don't talk well. They can push people
mm-hmm.
into privacy, but if they get in front of 200-300 people, they get stage fright.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never in my life heard a famous designer except Lowy, maybe, make a talk in front of 200, 300, 400 people, IDSA fellows or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Who wasn't scared to death.
Mm-hmm.
That's a strange thing to say. Or if they do get up, they make a horrible talk,
mm-hmm.
and they don't know what to do. When I was at U.S. Steel, I had two of these circular
mm-hmm.
areas that contained 80 slides apiece.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd give a talk with all these slides and illustrate them and describe them so that these people could understand what I was trying to say, you
mm-hmm.
know. Right. And if they saw the picture and I illustrated and described it, I knew that they would remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these people, they charge $3,500 for a talk, and you'll never see one slide in a million. You know, all they do is holler, or they shake their fist, or they illustrate. Or,
mm-hmm.
And I never believed in that. I always mm-hmm. thought that if you illustrate with a picture or a photograph and show them what you're thinking,
mm-hmm.
they never forget it.
Right.
gave one talk. And I don't know who I had do these things. I remember it was loaded with beautiful cartoons of this fellow going into the styling section, being stepped on, and finally building himself up so he could be impressive. And these were all done in cartoons,
mm-hmm.
little line drawings,
mm-hmm.
White lines on black background.
Mm-hmm.
God, it was fantastically successful. Nobody had ever done it before, you know. And I don't know what the hell happened to us down the basement somewhere.
Oh, I can look that up.
But it was very effective, hand hammering, and people never forgot it. They'd come up years later and they'd say, remember that cartoon talk you gave? Well, barely, you know. And they thought it was just, and they never forgot it. You know, the damn thing just went on, and it was another new idea and a way of speaking. And
mm-hmm.
I learned so much from the Dale Carnegie course, because fortunately, he was one of the first people who ever taught a really good speech course, and certainly effective.
Mm-hmm.
And you go from being scared to death to a point where you get so damn used to it that you look forward to making the next talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to get every one of my boys to take this speech course, but they never have.
They never have. Still being given, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Very famous.
Mm-hmm.
When your father says it, it doesn't mean a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else that you admire said, like if Raymond Loewy said, why don't you take this course? Or mm-hmm. if Harley Earl had said it,
mm-hmm.
hell, you'd be down there tonight, you know, signing up, spending your $300-$400 for that speech course. As an example, when I realized how little I knew of engineering, having done mechanical drawing and illustrative drawing and perspective drawing and all those Studebaker trucks and so forth,
mm-hmm.
I went to Charlie Belsky's engineering course over on Santa Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of our engineers at Ford, Charlie Belsky, a very famous little Jewish engineer, and he did these things at night, and every Monday night I'd be there. And the other guy that was there was Ed Cole, president of GM.
Well,
yes. Ed and I became good friends.
Later designed the Corvair.
3 years, nobody ever knew that I was an engineer, that I took an engineering course.
Mm-hmm.
So I could sit there with the engineers, and every once in a while I could pick out a flaw, and it would just surprise the hell out of them. You know, hey, this damn thing won't fit. You can't get that truckload on that, because this is built the wrong way, or it's built backwards, or it's built sideways, or south by southeast, and they'd look at me like, how in the hell does he know that? You know? And I had more damn fun, because when Ed and I finished the course in 3 years, he was vice president over there, and I was a little executive manager over here, but
uh-huh.
Charlie asked me whether Ed wouldn't give the talk at the end of the course,
mm-hmm.
and he asked me whether he would do the engineering and I would do the design. I said,
mm-hmm.
sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote up a whole damn talk about what I thought at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Biased here and there, and idealistic here,
sure.
and there, and whole damn time came, we gave the talk at the Rathskeller down on, I think, 2nd Avenue. I'm not sure anymore. And the time came, in about 3 days before the talk, I said, gosh, I wonder why I haven't heard from Ed. You know. So I called. And his secretary said, oh, he said that. She says, Ed's been expecting your call. She says, could you please send over your portion of the design speech so he can retaliate or agree with you on how to build all of the things you're working on in styling? I said, sure. So I sent it over. The night came, and I gave my portion of the talk, and Ed got up. He gave the most beautiful talk you've ever heard. And each of the things that I had outlined, he gave an answer or